This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Coming up, we've got all the news and views from Manchester City's week. It's your club, and this is your show.
A bit of a snooze fest to end the week with Wednesday's 0-0 draw against Sporting Lisbon, but there were a few positives to take from the game. A couple of youngsters looked right at home, and Scott Carson kept his first clean sheet in three and a bit years in senior football, so it wasn't all bad, especially coming after such a comprehensive win over Manchester United last weekend. Welcome to this week's Blue Moon Podcast, a show that's probably going to focus more on the Manchester derby, given the closeness of the Premier League title race. After a couple of dodgy performances, it was good to put a team to the sword once again, and even better, it being United. Also on today's show, we'll preview the coming match with Crystal Palace with the help of the Palace blogger and podcaster Hopkin looking to curl one. And we'll hear from one City fan who's got an interesting story to tell from a previous trip to Selhurst Park. More on that later. But let's focus first on the week of football just gone. I'm David Mooney and I've got two legacy City fans joining me for today's show in the shape of Tony Burns.
Hello.
And Guy Burke.
Hello everyone.
I was just saying, I've belatedly realised that we've got Tony and Guy. So if at any point we want to slip in some haircut puns, go for it. You know,
no problem.
Yeah.
No problem at all.
let's start with that performance against United, Guy, because after Spurs and Everton, it feels like the display against United was just as important as the result. I mean, the result was pretty good, but the way they did it as well was important, wasn't it?
It was, especially second half. I mean, the first half was very, very odd. I thought it was showing United far too much respect. Very sort of hesitant, you know, committing to tackles and stuff like that. A lot of misplaced passes, I thought, first half. The first goal, obviously, was first few minutes, perfect settler for the team. Then let them back in the game. Stupid goal to give away, which we'll probably talk about later, but just an absolute giveaway goal. And then 2-1, De Bruyne scored again. Could probably have had one or two more maybe before half-time. And then second half, they must have had the proverbial half-time rocket off the boss because they just ripped them anew on second half.
Yeah.
You know, and 4-1 flattered United at the end of the game. You know, 6 or 7-1 would have been a more realistic, you know, viewpoint on the game from my point of view.
Yeah, Tony, I was going to say, it's really encouraging, isn't it, that it was a slowish start, but then, like, second half, there was no question about how dominant City had been.
Well, indeed. I mean, you said, you know, was the display as important as a result? And I thought a bit of both, really, because the Spurs game, I mean, from a viewing perspective, was a good game of football to watch, but I think what it did was highlight our vulnerability to a team with a rapid counter-attack, and we got mugged. We couldn't see the game out. I thought the Everton game was a game where we got away with it. We absolutely got away with it with the penalty business, the VAR decision. So, and from a points perspective, given where Liverpool are, absolutely obvious that every point is vital. So I think we had to get back to our best, and we did. I mean, the second half was absolutely, I mean, I don't think, I came out of that game not really being able to remember when I've enjoyed a game, being at a game as much as that. Yeah. And that's, I mean, partly obviously because it was United. And I think as Guy just said, 4-1, United got away with it. They absolutely did.
Yeah, it was kind of a damning indictment on United's performance, given that it felt like City were so dominant that they took the foot off the gas from about 70 minutes onwards, and it was just like they were in cruise control, and yet United were still kind of like swinging and getting nowhere near them. Guy, what do you think the difference was between the halves? Was it simply that Guardiola got them in at half time and said, "Listen, you need to be a bit more careful with your passing it."
I can't think of any other reason than that. I'm sure some tactical expert will come on and say Bernardo Silva pulled one of his socks up a bit longer than the other one. I don't know. But to me, I think it probably was as simple as that. They must have got in at half-time and said, these are garbage. These are absolute garbage. We should be thrashing these. So get out and do it. And they did. Yeah. You know, I've forgotten, actually. I mean, like Tony said, I'd forgotten how nice it is to beat United, actually. Because there was a little bit of blasé, and I wind the few Reds I do sort of come in contact with, which I try not to do too many. I give them the perfect wind-up, which they used to give us. Well, you know what? Liverpool's a bigger game than United for City now, or Chelsea. Oh, it was Chelsea before that, you know, the way they used to do. And it works a treat, as it does, because they're very, very thin-skinned, as we know. And I sort of went into the game thinking, well, it's 3 points, and it could be Brentford were playing today. It could be Norwich, please. But it was very, very nice. Very nice, especially where I was sat on South Stand 3, and you've got a good view of the away fans to the right, and they weren't pleased.
Yeah, it was a good.
Couldn't happen to nicer people.
It was a good empty ad away end, wasn't it? By the end of it.
Yeah. They all sort of went and stood on the concourse downstairs, staring at the. I suppose the TVs were off as well, because that'd be showing the game, wouldn't it? But staring at how much pies were or whatever, you know. Which
yeah.
You know, there you go.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that, like, in just in terms of the one bit of fairness, I will just add on this one is that at the start of the game, the first 20 minutes or so, to be fair, I thought United were quite decent, and I hadn't expected them to actually press us as much as you did and as high as you did. I wasn't troubled by that, because it takes a better team than United to do that for a full game.
Yeah.
And I thought in the first half, I thought, for me, I thought it was Grealish's best game. I thought his link-up with Foden and Bernardo, I thought, was spot on. I thought De Bruyne was exceptional throughout the game. And I think, you know, you asked Guy what was different in the second half, and I think it was just that ability for the team, whether it was just sheer determination to absolutely put the game away and to finish a game without any pity on the opponents. But in terms of objectivity and balance, United were just dismal at times. That second half, they were desperate. After that third goal, it was a shocker.
Yeah. We'll come to the individual players shortly. But I've had this info from Adam Carter at statcity.co.uk that just kind of underlines how dominant City have been under Guardiola, because in scoring in the derby, City made it goals in 300 different matches under Guardiola. Only one other City manager has ever reached that tally. That was Les McDowell. He managed 486 in total. Guardiola reached goals in 300 games in 33 matches quicker than McDowell did. Guardiola did it in his 335th match, McDowell in his 368th. And in terms of games that City have played under Guardiola, they've scored in pretty much 90% of them. 89.6% of games under Guardiola they've scored in. So it just underlines, Guy, how dominant City have been in the last 6 years.
I think it underlines how good Les McDowell was as a manager. I know this is a crusty special edition, but even I don't remember Les McDowell as manager, and I'm pretty sure Tony doesn't either. However, my dad used to tell me about Les McDowell, how he was he was manager of the 50s, obviously the Troutman final, and the year before City got to the final, didn't win the cup against Newcastle. But I don't think, and no doubt some stat would bowl me out on this, but I don't think City ever troubled the sort of top end of the first division in those days very often. So, you know, the best sort of thing was a cup run anyway. So in terms of success, I don't think he was up there with Mercer or Mancini or Guardiola, certainly, but he was certainly well-liked by the fans, McDowell. And I seem to remember my dad telling me when he got sacked, for whatever reason, I don't know, I think it was probably a dispute with the City board at the time, he actually used to go on the Kippax and pay himself in.
Yeah.
And just stand with a normal, you know, hoi polloi on the Kippax to watch the games, you know. And I think a bloke called George Poyser, wasn't it, who got it? It was a bit of a yes man to the board of directors, basically, how he got the job, you know. So, obviously, you know, Guardiola's stats are just phenomenal. Yeah. You know, as you can, throughout his, you know, is it how he's still only been a coach in total for what, 14 years, 13 years?
Yeah. And, I mean, and most of it at City now as well. So
most of it, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, he's how people, and of course, we get all like, oh, would he do it at Scunthorpe? And the thing, I think he probably would. Or he'd probably make Scunthorpe a better team than they are now, certainly.
Yeah, I'd rather not try at the moment, though. I'd rather keep him till the end of the season.
He's got enough to concentrate on at the moment.
Yeah. Tony, you were talking about Grealish earlier on. Just looking at the derby, obviously, because he didn't feature in midweek. That's been, I mean, you said it yourself, it's been lauded as his best performance for City. I don't think he's been as bad as has been made out this season. A lot of people seem to put a lot of pressure on his shoulders. I think he's had a good season.
I think he has. I think that was possibly easily his best performance in a high-pressure game. But actually, I like Grealish. I think he brings a lot to the team. I don't think he's always set the place alight in the way that some people might think a £100 million player perhaps ought to. But actually, if you look at his contribution to the team, I think he pulls players towards him. I think he creates space. And actually, he's in pretty good company with a few other players who didn't quite reach the heights that others thought they should in the first season with Pep. Bernardo, Rodri, was it Cancelo where there was talk of him wanting to go in his first season? So if he takes that path, I think there's everything to be beyond excited about next season. I think he's fantastic. And his link-up in particular at weekend with Foden and Bernardo. I mean, Wan-Bissaka and Lindelof in that first half, there's a reason why Mahrez didn't see much of the game in the first half. It was all down that side with Grealish and co. I think he had some unpredictability and I love it when he runs at players. I'd like to see a bit more of that from him. But no, I think he's done all right. Absolutely.
Yeah, it was that. I think Mahrez commented after the game that he only touched the ball about four times in the first half. And when you would say, wouldn't you, with the success that Grealish, Bernardo, and Foden were having down that side, then I mean, of course, Mahrez only touched it. You would keep going back if you keep going back to the well that you can drink from, don't you, Tony?
Absolutely. And there were times in that first half where Wan-Bissaka and Lindelof, they literally didn't know which way to turn. And I thought they would sort of, it was just a great game. But your point, a great performance from Grealish, but your point generally about Jack Grealish this season, I think he's been fine. I think he's made a good contribution. And his contribution, I don't mean this in a literal sense, but you know, in the way that Jesus, there's been this criticism, oh, he doesn't get enough goals and all of that. But look at what he does for the team. I think it's much more than that that's in your face sort of thing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly that. Guy, just on Mahrez as well, because obviously the second half, if the first half belonged to Grealish, the second half belonged to Mahrez. He has become Mr. Reliable in front of goal, hasn't he?
And again, one of the few things that annoys me about City fans in general at the moment, certain sections of the crowd have always got to have a whipping boy. It was Mahrez last season. It's Grealish this season. It was Bernardo probably a couple of seasons before that. And again, like Tony said about Grealish, I don't think Grealish has been that bad at all. There's been a few under-par performances. I think no one can sort of say different. I'm not too impressed about him getting photographed on Deansgate at 3 a.m. out of his skull. You know, for a professional footballer these days to do that is stupid. But his actual performances, I think, have been fine. But we have certain members of our fan base only happy when they're slagging a player off. And this season, it's Grealish. The season before was Mahrez. And Mahrez is possibly player of the year this year, the way it's going. You know, there's always a few good candidates there. I think he just got player of the month, didn't he, for the whatever it is supporters club thing they vote on. And I'd say at the moment he must be pretty much out in front for player of the year, Mahrez.
Yeah, we've not even touched about De Bruyne, who ran the show in that first half as well. Guy, after the game, Guardiola said that the real Kevin was back. He's had an odd season, hasn't he, De Bruyne? He's really kind of coming in and out of the team.
Yeah, and very hot and cold.
Yeah, I wonder how much of it is he's still struggling with the injuries from last season. I mean, he had COVID at the start of the season as well.
It's been a bit hot and cold. Certain games, he's been quite anonymous by his standards. But he seems to pull stuff out of the bag when it's needed. Chelsea game at home, again, wasn't particularly impressive in a game, yet he pulls out a wonder goal to win the game. Last Sunday, probably his best game of the season. Yeah. And you know, run everything. And, you know, the problem is De Bruyne, the bar's set so high with De Bruyne's standards in it. What is a slightly below standard game for him is way above standard for 99% of players. So, you know, we've got to sort of look at it at that perspective as well, I think, yeah.
Tony, I think when you watch De Bruyne, you can tell, don't you, that he hates United. It's as simple as that. He hates United.
Who doesn't?
Yeah. I just think with De Bruyne, I think the point Guy made, though, about by his own standards, he set the highest of standards. So if he's a bit off, and I think, as you said, that he's had COVID. He had the injury he picked up on international duty?
There was the Champions League final as well.
Yeah, so, and, you know, the post-COVID, the COVID and post-COVID world's been an odd time for everybody, really. And I think I've seen him saying that he's struggled a bit with COVID. But if he is back, the real Kevin, as Guardiola said, then what a time to come back against them. And for the running for the season,
yeah,
at the end of the season. And just, can I just say, because you ask Guy about Mahrez, I mean, what about his penalties?
Yeah,
you know, he's not bad, is he? You know,
yeah, you need him on the pitch just in case somebody gets felled in the box these days, don't you? That's the that's the thing.
The other thing about Mahrez, yeah, he has that sort of. That almost like trademark move where he's coming in, he's drifting across the box. Everybody knows what he's going to do, but nobody seems to be able to stop it. I mean, it's fabulous. Absolutely exceptional.
Yeah. I want to touch on Kyle Walker because of, obviously, he was suspended for his second Champions League game in midweek. We had this question on last week's show, and I wanted to revisit it after his display in the Manchester derby and Guardiola's comments this week on his red card in Leipzig. Last week, Paul got in touch on Twitter to say, are you worried about Walker? He's not been that involved recently, and I wonder if being beaten by Harry Kane for Spurs' winner after he gave the ball away on top of his Champions League suspension has left him a little bit in the doghouse. We kind of batted it away on last week's show, and then Guardiola was asked about the red card in the build-up to the game in midweek. This is what he said.
And on Walker's suspension, I don't think we've asked you about the appeal being turned down.
He deserved it.
But there have been examples.
Kyle Walker deserved the three. When one player do this stupid thing, he deserved three banned players. I'm sorry. I'm not so kind to Kyle in this kind of action.
Have you, how much?
Still, I'm so angry with him.
Yeah, it looks like it.
So angry.
Have you, what have your discussions with him been like about that incident?
No, he knows it. It's not necessary to discuss about that. So, it's so important, Kyle Walker, for us. You see the game he played against United? Red in Leipzig, qualify already, 75, 80 minutes, and make this kind of action. So he deserves the three games. The club appeal, I was not agree. He has to do it because in other cases it was quite similar. It was just two games. He deserved it. Hopefully he learned for the future. I said right after the game, personally. But when they asked me about that, he deserved it. He deserved.
You're listening to the Blue Moon Podcast.
What do you make of that, Tony? He's not doing a very good job of hiding the fact that he's angry there, is he?
No. And it's fair enough because... It was a challenge that didn't need to be made, and to be out for those games is a miss. But in terms of, are we worried about Kyle Walker? In a word, no. Pep wasn't happy with his booking, and that's perfectly understandable. And I thought it was unusual to see Pep so publicly annoyed, but I suspect there's a big message there for the team anyway. But I'm not worried about Kyle Walker. I'm always happy to see him in the starting lineup. And as for the, did you say in your intro to that bit that we were blaming him for losing the ball for the goal that Kane scored? I mean, in that game, he was a contributor to that. But Kane was exceptional in that game. It's probably the best I've seen him play against City. So I'm not worried about Kyle Walker. I'm disappointed in missing the games, but not worried about him.
Yeah, I just wonder as well, Guy, if obviously that was ahead of a game that City were leading 5-0. I just wondered if it was a message to any of the other senior players to say, listen, like, this game is over. Don't do anything stupid ahead of the next knockout round.
Yeah, probably so. Yeah, I mean, the way Guardiola then, you know, not the sort of thing Walker would patch up with a bar of dairy milk on the boss's desk, is it, or something like that. So, yeah, I mean, it's, I mean, it was, I mean, again, we Walker gets stick from certain fans as well. A lad I know, he's slagging him off all the time. And to be quite honest, with the United goal on Sunday, I thought he had a bit of a point, because he was, I don't know what he was doing. Where was he? He was hopelessly out of position for the, when the ball went through, and whatever. I mean, it happens. You know, players make mistakes. We know that. You know, defenders make mistakes and usually leads to goals. Strikers make mistakes and it's easily forgotten about. It's one of those, isn't it? But no, as Tony says, I like Walker. If I was picking the team, he'd certainly be my first choice fullback. So, you know, live and let live, I suppose, and just hopefully the mistakes he makes don't contribute to anything that might cost us trophies or the league title or whatever, yeah.
Yeah. Let's focus a little bit on that midweek Champions League game. And it was not really too many headlines out of it. I think the biggest headline, Tony, was the youngsters that played, because CJ Egan-Riley didn't really look out of place at right back all night. He had that spell at the end where he was keeping the ball under pressure. And I was like, yeah, you've definitely been trained at City. What did you make of him?
I thought he was terrific. I mean, to be honest, and Betty, I didn't really sort of take much notice of, but Riley, I thought it was really eye-catching. And the thing that, I mean, I think the passage of play towards the end, it was that way he's knocking about with stones and whatever. And it was fantastic. But the key thing about him is yet another one, stepping up into the first team and looking at home in front of the crowd with the other players. I thought it was terrific and barely put a foot wrong. I thought he had a terrific game. Terrific game.
Yeah, and the other headline guy was James McAtee came on at halftime. Guardiola never makes changes at halftime, and here he is bringing on a kid at halftime, and then he slots in just like he just looks comfortable, and he like there was a point kind of like 10-15 minutes into the second half, and my instinct was, you know, McAtee is involved here. He's very involved.
Yeah, he's had a few minutes, hasn't he? Late subs and what have you, but yeah, as you say, a decent half to play, and yeah, I mean, it's very rarely any of these youngsters come on and they don't sort of seem impressive, does it? You know, and as I say, I must mention one thing about the lad, Egan Riley. I got a text while the game was on from a well-known sports journalist who's well-known to me and you, David, who resides in Berlin, who said, on my trip over next, we should get a song going for Egan Riley to the tune of Eaton Rifles by The Jam. And the best I could come up with is "Hello, hooray! He's not Andy Gray; he's Egan Riley," which needs a bit of work, admittedly. But
yeah, I think I was going to say we might need to workshop this one, might we?
I think so. Yeah. So that was notable, as I say, and you know, a typical journalist got nothing better to do but put jokes while the game's on. You know, and again, yeah, the youngsters come on, and you know, he's not going to throw a youngster on just for the sake of it. He's going to play him because he believes they're ready to contribute something. And yeah, I've yet to see a City youngster, and certainly since Guardiola's been there, who's come into the first team and not looked like he could be a decent prospect, you know. And it's hopefully we see a lot more of them.
I think it's the key about any of them that come in, and the three last night, I mean, Riley in particular, but the three of them, they look comfortable. That's the key thing. They don't look out of place.
The best you could
and that says everything, I think, really. That's everything. Yeah.
Going to finish the first part of the show with a word on, we talked about the youngest, let's talk about the oldie, because Scott Carson got a run out, his first senior game without conceding since December 2018. And there was a good save in there as well, Tony. I thought he'd done himself in with that save, but it was a good save.
Yeah, well, not only was it, did I think he'd done himself in myself, I thought that was a sure goal. I mean, we're sort of behind that, and I thought they're going to score. So I was so pleased that he made that save, because you know, just to keep the clean sheet. But yeah, brilliant. And I think there's I hadn't really noticed until today when I saw a picture online, there's a lovely sort of embrace between Edison and Carson, and what looked like a really genuine look of Edison being really pleased to give up his place for Carson. So lovely for the team, lovely for Carson. And he made a good save. So, yeah.
What more can you ask for? Guy, he's talked about. You hear the players talk about him, and he's talked about like some grandfather figure in the squad. And like he's 18 months older than me. I don't know how I feel about that.
He's bloody 29, what, 26, 29 years younger. You know, so long way to go. Yeah, he's well regarded, isn't he, by everyone. And he's you know, and he's, did you know, by the way, and I didn't know this till this morning, I heard it on the radio driving to work. He's only played once before in the Champions League before last night. And that was for Liverpool v Juventus, 2004-2005 season. And of course, Liverpool won the Champions League that season. Now, do you like omens? I don't know.
Hello. I don't believe in omens, but I'm willing to suspend that belief.
Well, neither do I.
There you
go, yeah.
Yeah.
And he's also Cumbrian, of course, and Cumbria has a very few sort of top sort of professional players have made it from Cumbria. I mean, Emlyn Hughes was from Barrow in Furness when it was still in Lancashire, of course, which is now in Cumbria. And the only one I can think of, top-level players, Cumbrian, Glenn Murray. Who was started off with Workington Town and played wherever, didn't he? Crystal Palace, Brighton, wherever. Yeah. So,
feeling,
yeah, Carson's...
Feeling well out of my depth here with the geography talk.
Well, Carson's flying the flag for Cumbria. If there is a Cumbrian flag, I don't know.
Yeah. Cumbrian listeners, get in touch. Let us know. Find out. we'll find out if there is a flag. Yeah. Let's have a look at the game with Palace. Crystal Palace are the only team left who could join Spurs in taking 6 points off Pep Guardiola this season. I've been speaking to Dan, who runs Hopkin Looking to Cool One, to find out how Palace's season has been going after that Etihad win.
I think if you look at it in isolation, our actual away results haven't been fantastic at all. I'm off the top of my head, I think the win at Man City was our only away win this season other than Wolves in the Premier League just most recently, weekend just gone. So it's not as though you look at the results that we've had, as well as Watford, a week before that, we've suddenly had this sort of purple patch away from home in the last couple of weeks. But in many ways, sort of the Patrick Vieira era has been one in which our performances haven't necessarily got the results they've deserved. And you look at that Manchester City game in isolation, it was almost as if every single thing we did across that 90 minutes just worked perfectly. It's been frustrating because I think if you look at it, it depends whether or not you view XG as a sort of decent representation of a team's performance. But we've been a team that have performed very, very well and dropped a lot of points late on. So at Manchester City, to be 1-0 up going into the last couple of minutes and managing to get a second goal really was the icing on the cake.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of recent performances, I'm going to come to this. You've got a little kind of mini winning run going. There's only been the draw at against Burnley that's kind of the blotted the copybook in there. Form, it feels like form's good at the moment.
It is, yeah. To be honest with you, it's the entire season has been one that has seen our fan base be overwhelmingly positive. I think it was from neutral perspective. A season where many people assumed that Patrick Vieira was too big a risk, that there was going to be too much in terms of player turnover, that trying to take us away from a style of football that was more defensive and sort of solid under Roy Hodgson to one that was more expansive under Patrick Vieira was going to be a bridge too far. But for most Palace fans, I think I speak when I say this, we've just enjoyed the ride. And to see us, you know, now in the top half of the table and with an FA Cup quarter final on the horizon, it's just a very good time to be a Crystal Palace fan, really.
Yeah, I was going to come to Vieira because I think a lot of us saw it as a risk. I saw it as a risk at the start of the season. But it feels like it's working.
It definitely is. I think it's difficult, obviously, if you're not embedded within a football club to understand the whole ethos. But we sort of treaded water for 18 months to 24 under Roy Hodgson. And, you know, he did what he had to do in terms of keeping us in the Premier League. But the squad was reaching a point where it had to be reshaped. It had to have a lower age profile. And I think everyone at the football club knew that Roy Hodgson wasn't necessarily the man to oversee that. And, you know, whether or not you look at Vieira's managerial CV and say that it necessarily stacked up in terms of Premier League quality, players like Michael Olise or Mark Gahey or Wilfried Zaha, Abir Ayeze, you know, they see Patrick Vieira. And there's someone there that they've grown up watching and idolising. You know, he was the captain of the Invincible side, a true famous Premier League midfielder. And I think in the immediate, that side of things really helped him sort of get his message across and win the respect of the squad immediately, where Roy Hodgson potentially just had too much of an age gap. And whilst he may have had the respect, I don't think they necessarily would have bought into a style of football that was going to be more expansive under Roy.
In terms of this season then, obviously you mentioned there, top half the table, doing well in the FA Cup. What are the hopes between now and the end of the season?
I think, you know, for a club like us, it has to be said that until you reach the sort of 35, 40 point mark, you're always going to be looking over your shoulder and thinking about the prospect of relegation and getting enough points on the board to avoid that.
Listen, mate, there's no way you're going down this season.
No,
absolutely no way, yeah.
But this is the thing, you see, before this little purple patch of form that we'd had, you know, we were going into these three games, Watford, Burnley, and then obviously Wolves away, thinking, well, you know, we need to pick up points. There's no getting around it. And obviously we've managed to pick up 7 points out of the 9 available, and it's really given us that boost necessary to go into these last run of games in the Premier League with a lack of pressure on our shoulders. And when you throw the FA Cup into the mix, obviously we're 90 minutes away from a Wembley appearance, and whilst you don't want to necessarily guarantee that you're going to get through, I think Everton, if you look at their season, have got bigger fish to fry at the moment in terms of their Premier League status. So hopefully for us, you know, it ends with a decent run of results in the Premier League and hopefully a Wembley appearance thrown in.
Yeah, just looking at this game on Monday evening, are Palace fans quietly confident about this? Just given the form recently, given what you did at the Etihad, there's no reason to fear City, I guess, is there?
I mean, obviously, you look at what Manchester City have done this year, what they've done throughout the time that Pep Guardiola's been in charge, top of the league, they're scoring goals of fun, they're doing well in Europe. It's not as if, you know, we go into any game against a top side and assume we're going to get points, but it is almost the definition of a free hit, really. You know, because even if we were sort of at home and fighting for points, there's pressure on us to try and stay in the game as long as possible. Whereas this is almost a case of, you know, you've got the 3 points on the board from the Etihad game. You've got relative comfort in terms of our league position. And I think if you look at the high-energy football that we've played for the most part under Patrick Vieira, with Conor Gallagher, with Michael Olise, Wilfried Zaha, etc., then we can really have a go at it. And I think, you know, Pep Guardiola is on record as saying that he doesn't like playing Crystal Palace because of the compact nature of our team and the fact that we are so good on the counter. So it really is the definition of a free hit, and one that hopefully our players and fans can enjoy watching.
I think it might also be because you keep beating him as well. That might put him off games against Palace. You mentioned Conor Gallagher. You've mentioned Wilf Zaha a lot. It feels like this is a proper team as well this season, built around those sorts of attacking players. I always think of Palace in the past and think, you know, that could be a little bit reliant on Zaha. These days, it doesn't feel like that.
No, without a doubt, we've certainly differentiated our attacking options. And I think, you know, it's often been a source of frustration for both our fans and for Wilf, because you look at a situation where a Manchester City or even, you know, a mid-table side will come up against Palace and they'll stick to a 3 men on Zaha, and that'll be the sort of main threat nullified. But I mean, Michael Olise is on the other flank at the moment, and he's just an absolute joy to watch. I've never seen, in Crystal Palace colours, a player with a higher ceiling as Michael Olise. It's quite insane to see what he can do at 20 years old. And obviously, when you've got him on one side and Zaha on the other, defences just don't really know where to go in terms of trying to double up on them, in terms of committing men to one side or the other. You've got Tariq Mitchell coming through, Mark Gaye in the centre of defence. It's just a very young core that appear to really enjoy playing together. And I think, you know, Patrick Vieira really has been the perfect man to mould all of it as, you know, a team unit, and got us, you know, playing in the right way and as a cohesive group. So it's just fantastic to watch.
Yeah, how do you think he'll approach Monday night? Because the game at the Etihad, again, he did a really, really good job of not necessarily pressing City, but making sure there was no spaces for them to kind of pass through. Do you expect a similar sort of setup again?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's quite easy from a neutral point of view to sort of see the way that we operate against top sides and not really notice too much of a difference between the Roy Hodgson approach and the Vieira one. The only difference that I can see as a fan who watches us every week is that when we do have possession now, I think we're far more confident in our ability to play through the lines. Joachim Anderson and Mark Gahey, for me anyway, as two centre-backs that can spray passes 30 or 40 yards relatively easily, are the sort of new base of our attacks. And quite often it will be a case of the two of them, you know, retaining possession and looking to build from defence rather than just knocking a ball in behind and letting one of the pacey players sort of run onto it. So as much as the counter-attack is still a huge weapon in our arsenal, I think we do have a better chance of retaining possession, even against the top sides, than we did when Roy Hodgson was in charge. And I expect that to be largely the case when we do get the opportunity to get our foot on the ball on Monday night.
Yeah. Dan, before we let you go, we've got a charity bet coming up a bit later on in the show. I'm notoriously useless at it, so I'm going to give mine over to you. What's your score prediction for this game?
Do you want me to be outlandish or do you want me to be realistic?
Do whatever you want, mate. It's entirely up to you.
Well, I'll tell you what, given the fact that I'm a Crystal Palace fan on a Manchester City podcast, we'll go with a 1-1 draw, I think.
Please give us your backing. Patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
That was Crystal Palace fan Dan, better known as HLTCO on Twitter. Before we get into the nuts and bolts of this game, Tony, it's a Monday night game. I want you to have a listen to this. This is Pep Guardiola speaking before City's Monday night trip to Stoke back in 2018. At the time, City had played three times on a Monday under him and they'd won one, drawn one, lost one. And then this is what he said.
Sometimes in Barcelona, when you think we'll play a play on Monday, when I remember a long time ago, it always was not good. I prefer to play on weekend, yeah, but all the teams play Sunday, so it's not about... just for my experience, I don't like.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Blue Moon Podcast.
Yeah, so not a fan of Mondays. Since then, City have won all six games on a Monday night. So Guardiola's record on Mondays, he's played 9, won 7, drawn 1, lost 1. Does it affect you at any point? Like the fact that it's a Monday night game, does that bother you?
No, not really. I mean, I don't think it bothers me any more than... a game played any other day of the week, really. No, I don't think so. I mean, what it does for players in terms of routine, who knows? But no, for me, it doesn't make any difference. No particular worries about that. Do I get worried about Palace as well on a Monday? Not especially. I think Palace have been half decent, really. I hope Mr. Vieira understands the importance of the game. but I'm expecting it to be I think it'll be a reasonably tight game. I think I've watched a little bit of Palace in recent weeks. I think they've only lost once in the last six games or so. And they played Chelsea, and that was a bit tight. So not particularly worried. Reasonably tight game, but I think we'll be okay.
Well, City's got a history of Monday night games, of course. Premier League first ever one at home to QPR, 92, wasn't it? Monday night.
Yeah.
I mean, the downside of it is, of course, is for fans travelling. I mean, I looked at the list of the Monday games that City have had in recent years, and for some reason I didn't go to Stoke away. I don't know why, probably because tickets were in short supply. But I did the Tottenham away on a Monday night at Wembley, which was... in October, wasn't it?
Very tight, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Did the Bournemouth away as well, mainly because we went to Bournemouth the year before, a group of us. There was 20 of us went, only two got tickets for the game. And we met a load of Bournemouth fans in a pub, great people, and we're still friends with them now, actually. So, and when it was the Monday night game the year after, of course, there was loads of tickets going, nobody wanted to go. So we went and met up with them again, and we still see him now. We saw him last year, and we got a door set every couple of years for a holiday. And we saw him last year on a weekend there. So, yeah, so that's the only thing. It's especially Crystal Palace is an absolute mare to get to, you know, really is. I've only been once, which was the New Year's Eve lunchtime kickoff, and we set off from here about 6 a.m, did it in about 4 hours because basically there was nothing on the roads, even in central London. It was deserted more or less, but on Monday it's going to be an absolute whatever, you know.
Yeah, got to get through London at rush hour.
Yeah, I don't envy anyone doing that at all. But and I did the famous Wigan Cup game as well.
Which one?
The Monday night one, FA Cup. Yeah, the FA Cup one.
It's just it's every time, isn't it?
There is. Yeah. But the Monday night one, the last one. So I think the only from a fan's point of view, it is a bit of a it is a pain because you've got to take a day off work, I suppose, or half a day either side of the evening game, if you know what I mean. But I wouldn't have thought the players makes that much difference, really.
Yeah.
You know, preparation won't be any different particularly.
And the record's pretty good as well. So, Selhurst Park, Tony, not an easy place to go to. It has been vital in previous City-Liverpool title races as well. Obviously, City winning their 2-0 the day that Chelsea Chelsea won at Anfield. Liverpool that season, obviously, as well, threw away a 3-goal lead there. It has played a role in the past, hasn't it?
It has, and I've only been to Palace once in recent years, and it was for that game. An absolutely dismal trip on the supporters' coach, which my son, Richard, had encouraged me to go on, which never again. but that we were there. We were in the concourse watching the Liverpool game against Chelsea when Gerrard slipped. It was just fantastic. So very fond memories of that. There were flares in the concourse and not those that I was wearing. There was beer being thrown up. And we won the game. Absolutely brilliant. So very fond memories. And as you said, that was it a week or two before City went there when Liverpool had thrown away that lead?
Yeah, I think Liverpool did it. They must have done it in there. It must have been their second last game of the season because City then had to. Oh no, City then had to go to Everton, did they? I can't remember this. There was Everton. Was there was Villa. Yeah.
Yeah.
The Liverpool Palace 3-3 was Monday night as well.
Yeah.
It's a bank holiday, I think. Might have been Easter Monday. I can't remember.
But so my biggest. I always remember that game at. Not so much the game, but the watching the. Being in the concourse watching the Steven Gerrard slip, and it was just fantastic. That's, you know, superb. So, but not necessarily an easy place to go to, but we've got a decent record there and tight, but I think we'll be okay.
Yeah, and I guess, Guy, the other side of it is, as we were talking about in the first part of the show, they've had that performance against United now to kind of go, okay, we can remember how we need to play, if that makes sense.
Exactly. I mean, I'm hoping the United game will be the catalyst now to kick on the season in all comps, really. You know, and barring obviously we've got a couple of players injured at the moment, but keep the squad relatively injury free for the last third of the season that it is now, and I think we've got a chance of winning all three. And I know it's you know, people say, oh, steady on and all this, but I don't see any reason why City can't win all three trophies they're still in this season, and I don't see anything but a reasonably comfortable win on Monday night. I honestly don't. Palace have done well. Patrick Vieira is doing very well there, and better than I thought he'd do, to be honest with you, but I can't honestly see anything past the City win on Monday.
Yeah, we'll come to predictions shortly. Tony, first things first, does Liverpool go in first or second bother you anymore? You think back to that 2018-19 title. It was that was hellish in the running, and we were kind of always talking about, oh well, Liverpool go first and then City have to respond, and City go first and Liverpool have to respond. I mean, does it matter these days? Both teams, you sometimes go first, you sometimes go second, but either way, you still got to win your game.
Yeah, well, the answer to that for me is sort of a yes and no. I mean, I'd always rather we stayed top, but in reality, sometimes the positions in the league, you just mentioned when it was that swapping about, they can be a bit distorted due to the scheduling and so on. And I think it was that the year when we'd beaten by a point or two, when there was, I remember seeing something on Sky saying, oh, the league's changed hands X many times. Well, it would do when you're scheduling games that way, you know. So this season, no, not so much so. I would like to, I hope that when we play Liverpool in a couple of weeks, I hope that we've got the points cushion in hand then. But does first or second matter? Not really.
Guy, that Liverpool are away at Brighton. City are 6 points ahead. They've got a game in hand. Liverpool at home is now 2 games away. And no matter what, and no matter how you kind of look at it, that game is going to be crucial. But I guess psychologically, it's important for City to not be able to lose top spot in that game, is it?
You'd say so, wouldn't you? But I mean, the Liverpool game, because of where it was scheduled anyway, was always going to be not a title decider necessarily, but always going to be a significant sort of marker as to where the title would go. I mean, there's so much guff talked, isn't there, these days about the, you know, I mean, Liverpool won't drop any points now before the end of the season. Brighton away is by no means a given. In the same way that Palace away is that by no means evil. Brighton are not a bad team at home. And, you know, who knows? A draw possibly there. Yeah. Maybe, you don't know.
Do you get nervous?
A little bit, yeah. A little bit. But I think, to be honest with you, I think that's what your football fans... If you don't get nervous as a football fan, then you shouldn't really be a football fan. If you just, you know, that's part of the thing. That's part of the... You know, I know fans say, oh, I'm dead nervous about the game. I don't like this. I said, that's what you're a football fan for. You know, we've been to plenty of games where we're not nervous because it was almost inevitable we were going to get battered. Or in recent years, there's been a lot of games where we're not nervous because it's more almost inevitable that we're going to win. Whereas games like even United last week, in view of City's stuttering run of late, that was by no means nailed on before kickoff. And obviously, Liverpool, whatever state of play it is when we play Liverpool, whether we're still 6 points ahead or lot or more or whatever, you know, it's still going to be a game. It's still going to be a game on that you're going to be nervous about. And that's, as I say, that's what we're all football fans for: to be excited, to be a little bit nervous, to be downtrodden.
At weekend, I didn't quite feel the nervousness because it was in the way I used to, because it was United and a derby. Because at the end of the day, United are not really a very good team. I was more nervous about making sure we had the 3 points because of what it would mean if we didn't get them in terms of Liverpool, rather than it being United. So, you always have that sense of, in that way, yeah.
Right, well, let's try and raise some money for charity. We've raised £1,230 so far this season for the Man City Fans Food Bank support. They're collecting for the Trussell Trust to help those living in food poverty in Greater Manchester. William Hill is giving each of us a £10 correct score single on City's games. We heard a bit earlier on that Dan, the Palace fan, is going for a 1-1 draw on Monday night. That's 10-1 and £100 if he's right. Tony, what's your score prediction for this one?
2-0 City.
2-0 City is 11-2 and £55 if you're right. Guy, what are you having?
I'll go 3-0 City.
3-0 is 15-2 and £75 if you're right. Remember, you've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change. And for more on responsible gambling, have a look at begambleaware.org. Now, Monday's game is live on Sky, which means it should be fairly easy to watch. In Guardiola's first season, though, it was a trip to Selhurst Park in the fourth round of the FA Cup that was almost impossible to view unless you were there. I say almost because it was streamed live on Periscope by one supporter in the away end. Josh Chambers was responsible. He's been speaking to Dom Farrell for City Is Ours at the Manchester Evening News.
I knew going to the game that it wasn't going to be televised. So my dad usually watches all the games, finds a stream if he can't get up north anymore to watch them. I think I saw a tweet from someone. I'd posted a picture of me, or a picture of the ground or something on Twitter. And a few people started replying being like, film it. And I was thinking, yeah, why not? So I gave it. So I got Periscope out and started streaming, and then it just started to like blow up. I think because people were looking around and there was nowhere else streaming it. So I think my dad had even stumbled across the stream. I hadn't told him where to look or anything. It sort of crashed my phone a little bit. I couldn't do anything with it. It just started overheating, but it was good. I think at half time I realised how many people had actually tuned in.
And how many was that at half time? And obviously, your phone probably needed 15 minutes in your pocket at that stage.
Yeah, yeah, it did. I think I looked back and it was about 86,000, maybe, that said that there was like watching it live, which is a bit mad. I think it then said there was a few, you know, like another 30 odd or 40 odd thousand that watched it replay. So I don't know what the final number was, but yeah, so it did, yeah, it did sort of. I mean, there was one awkward moment when my phone, I was trying to zoom in, people were commenting, and so I was kind of trying to interact with people commenting and get like a better shot of I don't know, the screen with there's a replay for a goal or something, and I accidentally like double tapped and it flipped the camera around, and then it crashed and it wouldn't flip back. So there was a period where I'm panicking. I've got all these people watching my face. And so that was funny. And I think it ended up becoming a bit of a meme. I think there's some kind of screenshots of my face going around City Twitter. So
yeah. So, I mean, so you became aware pretty much straight away that it was causing a bit of a major stir. And this was like a sort of a City Twitter memeable moment and things like that.
Yeah, a bit mad. I think like loads of people I've been following on City Twitter for ages, you know, making me laugh or just, you know, for updates, them kind of messaging me, DMing me, and people trying to set me up with like a power bank. They'd found someone in like a different aisle that had like a phone charger and things like that. But it was all, yeah, it was all quite nice. Just all the messages were positive. People saying that I was man of the match or, you know, needed a statue, things like that.
did you have to source a charger at half time or anything like that, or was the battery solid?
Yeah, the battery was all right. I think it managed to last. I think I found a charger at some point. But I mean, the second half I carried on. I sort of filmed it again, and I'd made friends by this point with a couple of people next to me, a guy called Robbie, and yeah, that was quite fun. So yeah, the second half it wasn't as I was more relaxed, I think.
Yeah, you just got into your groove as a sort of a live TV director, sort of on the fly. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I remember from it that there were a couple of times like I had not remembered, you'll be glad to know, about your face becoming a meme, but I do remember the stream sort of went down a couple of times and everyone on Twitter going, no, what's happened to the Periscope guy? What's going on? And worried they were going to have to listen to the radio again, like the olden days. So the game itself, what do you remember for the game? I mean, how much of the game were you actually sort of consciously watching? It must have been a really different football watching experience for you.
It was. And yeah, I don't know if I'd do it again, but yeah, it was, I mean, it was a good game. There was particularly things that stand out were kind of, Yaya scored a great free kick in the second half. Yeah. And I remember the guys I'd made friends with were calling, you know, were saying he was going to score. But I mean, they did call it. But to be fair, I think we all hoped he would. So it wasn't that outrageous. But but other than that, I think I sort of remember, I don't know, Sterling and Gabriel sort of some of their stuff, but nothing really. I don't remember a lot of the game, to be honest.
How does it feel in this strange and age to sort of be that little part of City folklore? Because I put the tweet out asking if anyone knew where to find you. And I mean, this is probably more reflective of the nonsense I put on Twitter, but that got more responses than most things I put out there, to be honest. It's like, you know, people do remember the Periscope guy, basically.
I love that. No, it does feel, I'd never really thought of it as like City folklore, like you said. But yeah, maybe there is a little bit of that. I think it does feel nice. I think I've never been recognised or anything for it, but and I was promised a lot of beers and pints and things, but I've never had one. But other than
let's hope that this brings those delayed pints in. No,
that would be good. I mean, I think I also found that there was a lot of people from around the world messaging me, which is a bit mad. I hadn't thought about. There's a Toronto fan group that had sort of got in touch, and people in Brazil and people all over the place. So I think there's it made me sort of realize a lot of that there's a lot more City fans out there. I think
you're listening to the Blue Moon podcast. You've made it this far, so don't give up now.
That was City fan Josh Chambers talking about the time that he streamed a game live to the internet via Periscope. Let's finish this week's show with some listener questions. Get in touch for next week on Twitter at Blue Moon Podcast. You can email us as well through the website, bluemoonpodcast.com. We start with Contemplative Jesus on Twitter, who asks, would City have been able to play United off the pitch in the same way if the centre-back pairing included Diaz? Diaz is the best defender of the lot, but he's also the weakest on the ball. Tony, what do you reckon?
Well, look, Contemplative Jesus, on the basis that if City had played me in the second half, would have played nice off the park, then, you know, if Diaz had played, it would have been the same. And to be perfectly honest, I've never thought of Diaz as being weak on the ball.
Yeah. Have you just had your knee done? Have you had a knee operation recently, if I remember rightly?
I did indeed, and before, after, or even during the operation, I still could have given some of them United players a game.
Oh, well, I'll team up, you knock them down. Guy, what do you make of it? Because obviously Diaz is the player that came in and really kind of secured City defensively. But in terms of ball playing, you would say probably Stones and Laporte are the two that you'd want in the team.
Like Tony just said, Diaz has a weakness. It's news to me, to be quite honest, because I've not seen it that evident, to be quite honest with you. I mean, maybe, you know, I dare say people better qualified than myself to say that Stones and Laporte are better ball players, maybe probably right, but I don't know. Diaz, when fit, is a shoe-in to the team. Diaz, there's not that many players you can who are saying when fit they're definitely in the team. Diaz is the first name on the team sheet, isn't he?
Yeah.
Let's be fair, and it's a question of who plays with him. Whether Stones done reasonably well at fullback at the moment, last few games, so maybe that's the way he'll get a few more games. But no, Diaz is the first name on the team sheet as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Let's finish with a sports fan on Twitter who says, while playing against the back five, Pep wants to put the right-footed player at the right and the left-footed player at left wing to expand the opposition back line. But why doesn't he use Mahrez at left wing when he has the best left foot? This is interesting because it's something that I was kind of calling for a few years ago, Tony. And yeah, like Mahrez will only ever play on the right-hand side. And like I think you said before, he's got the one move that he does and you can't stop it even though you know it's coming. Could he do that from the left, do you think?
Given his absolute ability, control and first touch, he could probably do it anywhere. But I think the simple answer, like, why doesn't he play him on the right, is he's superb where he is. I mean, he's fantastic. His ability to put a crossing from the byline, let alone his ability to drift across the 18-yard box, why fix something that's not broke?
Yeah, yeah. Guy, is he a player for you that, I mean, again, on the right-hand side has been exceptional, but we just haven't seen him on the left. Would you like to see him on the left?
I think that question from whoever it was is a perfect example of football fans overthinking too much. I mean, I'm willing to give the bloke who's probably the greatest coach in European, if not world football history, the benefit of the doubt on this one.
Oh, are you sure?
I think I might just let him have this one because, you know, I think he's better qualified than me. Anyone else listening to this, and certainly the guy who put the question in, as knowing where the best place is to play his players. So I think a lot of football fans overthink the game far too much these days, and that was a perfect example.
Yeah. Right, well, that's it for this week's Blue Moon Podcast. Thank you very much for listening, and thanks also to my guests for today's show, Tony Burns.
Thank you and goodbye.
And Guy Burke.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Don't forget, go and leave us a rating and a review wherever you can. It all helps people find the show. If you'd like to listen to some more, though, we've got some bonus podcasts for Patreon backers. This week's City fan, John Kavanagh, was talking us through his picks of City matches that shaped him as a fan. Here is a short clip.
If you turned up at Main Road at 10 o'clock, there'd be all the players' cars outside the main entrance. And around about 12 o'clock, a little blue door to the right of the steps, which went up to the executive offices. The little blue door was a bit like the stage door to the theatre. The little blue door was where the players emerged from, having been training. And almost to a man, they'd come out the blue door and light a fag. and nip across the road where there was a little cafe, and they'd go in there and have a cup of tea and a sandwich or whatever. But of course, yeah, we were all lurking there as kids, and we'd have our Topical Times football annual or our Charles Bookin football annual that we got for Christmas, and carefully having bookmarked the photographs of City players, be looking for to grab the player that featured and actually get them to autograph the photograph. And of course, some City players were more famous than others. I mean, obviously, probably the most famous at the time was Bert Trautmann, the goalkeeper.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the film The Keeper tells his story very well. But he was loved, and what a man, what a character.
Did you get his autograph in the end?
Well, I did, but it wasn't easy. He was a lovely fella, but my word, he lived up to the stereotype of a German. He would not consider signing any autographs until all the kids were lined up in front of him in a straight line. Come on, you boys, line up now. And I can hear him now.
Yeah.
And he made everybody line up. He would then sign every autograph offered to him, to be fair, and that took some time. And then he did not usually go to the cafe. He would then almost literally fold himself into his VW Beetle. He was a great big guy. And then drive off. But he was the image of a Teutonic hero. Tall, blonde, amazingly, looked like a bundle of health, but a great man, loved by everybody. And you knew you were in the presence of somebody special when you were near him.
That was a clip of this week's Patreon bonus show. It's available to listen to now for everyone who backs the show by £2 per month. You can also get the bonus shows in your usual podcasts app as well. They'll download automatically every Monday to your phone or whatever you use. Details are on patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast. I'll be back next week to review the game at Palace, so I'll see you then.
Was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please support the show. Patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.